Support comes from the Mahone Foundation, presenting the 15th annual Harbor Park Jazz Rhythm and Blues Festival, Saturday, August 17th, featuring saxophonist Paul Taylor, blues singer Nora Jean Brusso, Natty Nation, and the R&B band Christopher's Project, also a Racine Kenosha Firefighters Cook-Off and an Arts and Craft Village. Tickets online at MahoneFund.org. Funding scholarships for economically disadvantaged and academically deserving youth and healthy lifestyle initiatives in communities of color.
Support for WGTD comes from Music by the Lake, hosting Broadway television star and Tony Award-winning baritone Brian Stokes Mitchell with the celebrated Chicago Philharmonic, August 10th in Williams Bay. Use code WGTD10 at MusicByTheLake.com for a special offer.
This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of education leadership at UW Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Today's program features author Deb Douglas. Ms. Douglas has a new book from Free Spirit Publishing titled The Power of Self-Advocacy for Gifted Learners. Deb Douglas, who has a Master of Science in Education, consults and advocates for gifted children and teens, specializing in workshops that help students take charge of their own education. Previously, she was the Gifted Education Coordinator for the Manitowoc Public School District, a high school English teacher, an International Baccalaureate Diploma Program Coordinator, and President of the Wisconsin Association for Talented and Gifted. She lives in Madison, Wisconsin. Her original research on empowering gifted students to self-advocate has been published in The Roper Review and Parenting for High Potential. Her book, The Power of Self-Advocacy for Gifted Learners, A Guide to Supporting Students' Self-Advocacy, is available from Free Spirit Publishing. Her next book, No More Dreams Deferred, co-edited with Dr. Joy Davis, focuses on the barriers to self-advocacy for underserved gifted learners. Contributors include experts Donna Ford, Jaime Castellano, Marcia Gentry, Dina Brules, Robert Sene, and many others. I hope I pronounced them right. Deb is a frequent presenter at state and national conferences, as well as the 2017 World Council for Gifted and Talented Children in Sydney, Australia, and the 2018 European Council for High Ability in Dublin, Ireland. Wow, that's a lot. Welcome, Deb Douglas.
Thank you, Karen. I'm so happy to be here with you today.
Right. I'm excited to do this interview because I had a graduate student at the beginning of my higher ed career back in the early 2000s who was a gifted coordinator for the school district she worked in, and she really showed me that gifted education is one of those fields that seems to be really neglected in a lot of places. And so I found this book fascinating, and I think for our listeners who are parents or grandparents or teachers of gifted children, this might really be a helpful guide for them. So let's get started a little with the main question. What is wrong with the way we approach gifted education in our schools currently? What is the problem that you're trying to solve with this book?
Well, the first issue really is that there is no one way that we approach gifted education in our schools. Since there's no federal plan for serving gifted learners, each state is able to decide whether or not to provide programming. And within Wisconsin, we have several state statutes that require districts to identify and provide services for gifted students, but there are no teeth in the statutes. There is no state funding except for a few competitive grants, and no one is holding districts accountable. So the possibility that a gifted student will experience an appropriately challenging education is really totally dependent on where they live, what district or school district is available to them, and who within that district is ready but also willing and able to address their needs. And since we adults haven't been doing a very good job of assuring any form of consistency in how we educate gifted learners, I'm trying to put that power into the hands of the students themselves, encourage them to take charge of their own educations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And actually what's interesting about that is, I don't think this is exactly an analog, but of course there are statutes and very powerful federal statutes around special needs and which may or may not be the opposite of gifted. There are plenty of gifted students that have special needs. But do you have any sense of sort of why that law, that powerful law has been passed and we haven't done anything on this gifted side of the spectrum?
Well, I have some ideas. I'm not an expert on the IDEA, the Act for Individuals with Disabilities, but I do know that it was grassroots parent support that went to legislators that really got that ball rolling and brought the large amount of assistance to students with disabilities. On the other hand, we as a society just kind of feel that our brightest kids, those kids who have capacity for great understanding and high potential, will make it on their own. It's kind of a misconception, and we can talk more about that, but I think the myths about gifted kids have done, and the misunderstanding about what giftedness is, has done more to limit the energy behind supporting gifted students.
Well, that's a perfect segue, because I wanted to ask you how you define gifted learners, because I think people might have something in their own heads, or maybe everyone thinks their child is gifted. So what's sort of official to you, or is there an official organization with an official definition?
Well, let me begin by saying that I agree with parents that every child has gifts. But there's something different between having gifts and being gifted. You know, the federal definition, which was written way back in 1972 after the Marland Report was presented to Congress, defines gifted learners as those who give evidence of high achievement capability in areas, and this is kind of confusing too, in areas such as intellectual, creative, artistic, leadership, and specific academic fields. And so that kind of expands the areas of gifts that we typically think of as intellectual and academic. But then it goes on to say, gifted learners are those who need services or activities not ordinarily provided by the school in order to fully develop these capabilities. So I think there's two key phrases there. The first is give evidence of high capability. And that means that a student has potential for high achievement, but it does not necessarily mean that a gifted student is the student who is earning all A's and acing all tests. It's a student who has potential for high achievement. And then the second phrase I think that's important there is that the student needs services not ordinarily provided. And so when we think that if we've got a really good educational system, that the needs of the gifted child are going to be met within it, we can't be assured of that. The struggle for the schools on that definition is determining which additional services are needed and how can they be provided. So we also know that gifted learners are not all alike, and that educational definition by the federal government really focuses on kids in school. It doesn't focus on what giftedness is lifelong, because as one student said to me, I think my mom used to be gifted. And I said, why do you mean used to be? And she said, well, she was in a gifted program when she was in school. And I think that exemplifies our society's understanding of giftedness. It's if you're in a program, you're gifted. And if you're not in a program, then you're probably not. But there are so many variables in whether or not somebody's gifts are identified and somebody's needs are identified in the school system. You know, I like to share with students and parents and educators as well the work of George Betts and Maureen Neihardt. And they describe six different profiles of gifted kids. There's the successful kids who have adapted to the system and do really well. You know, teachers love them. Parents are proud of them. They get great grades. They do well on exams. They're successful because they've adapted. But then there are the creative kids who find the educational system really rigid and not meeting their needs, and kind of the divergent thinkers who may need something different than the traditional academic track. We also have underground gifted learners whose families or communities, their social, what I call their social milieu, does not value education, so they don't get the support and the understanding of how important their education is.
Right. So I think sometimes those kids in school experience even sometimes bullying, but certainly, you know, they're not lauded for their gifts. They're sometimes punished or ridiculed for them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or simply misunderstood. Mm-hmm. If we as schools, but also as communities and society, have this very narrow view that giftedness is intellectual academic achievement, mm-hmm. then we don't look for other types of gifts. And remember, the federal definition is talking about leadership skills and creativity and artistic, as well as the intellectual and academic. You know, even some of our gifted learners whose needs have not been met throughout the years become at risk of dropping out of school. Mm-hmm. And many do. And we lose them simply because they see that the educational system really hasn't cared for them, really hasn't learned who they are individually and supported them. Mm-hmm. You mentioned also that gifted kids can be twice exceptional.
Right.
Having disabilities of various, so it's physical, emotional, social, learning disabilities, and those kids, even if they have extraordinary potential, often wind up spending most of their time in education dealing with their disabilities rather than focusing on their abilities. Mm. And actually the sixth profile of gifted kids, and of course any student can embody many of these profiles at the same time and may change profiles over time. But I think that all of these students, our goal is to help them get on the road towards autonomy, where instead of adapting to the system, they figure out where they want to go and how they want to get there, and they adapt the system to meet their needs. Mm-hmm. And that's what self-advocacy is all about.
Okay. So the next question we've talked about a little bit, but you claim that struggling learners and gifted learners have a lot in common. So, you know, so there may be listeners who have a child that they know that has an IEP. There is no such thing for gifted learners. But can you tell us a little bit about what they might have in common?
Oh, I certainly can. And actually, there is, similar to an IEP, there are DEPs, differentiated educational plans, that many districts employ for kids who have been identified as gifted. Again, there is no systematic national way of doing that or national requirement for doing that, as there is with kids with disabilities. But I think that both struggling learners and gifted learners, I think of them as outliers. If you consider it like a typical classroom that includes students from all ability levels, and quite honestly, in the United States, most gifted learners are not in gifted specialty schools or gifted classrooms or even gifted cluster groups within classrooms. Most are just sitting in heterogeneous classrooms. So let's say this is a fifth grade classroom, and we know that teacher has a specific fifth grade curriculum to teach. These are the goals, these are the benchmarks that everyone needs to meet by the time they finish fifth grade. So the majority of the students in that class are probably going to be at grade level and capable of mastering those fifth grade goals. But the two groups of outliers in that classroom are the students with lower abilities who are at a disadvantage, and they'll struggle to master some or most of those goals, same goals. But as you said, fortunately, there's a great deal of funding available. So specially trained educators and assistants and curriculum are there to provide assistance to those struggling learners. But the group at the other end of the spectrum, however, are the students with advanced abilities. And really great research has found that students with academic giftedness may have already mastered most or all of the fifth grade goals before the school year begins. Mm-hmm. So they are outliers as well. And I consider this a matter of equity. Think about it. Which students in that classroom are going to have to work the hardest to achieve fifth grade goals? And which are not going to have to work at all? And that seems unfair to me. And as one elementary classroom teacher said to me, I want all of my students to have to work hard to learn something new every day. That's only fair. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, thinking about how struggling students and advanced learners are similar, they both need to advocate for themselves in order for the school to meet their needs. And as much as parents and teachers want to help, they have to understand that we can't read their minds. Students have to tell us if this lesson is just right, if this unit is too hard, if it's something that they've already understand completely, or is this subject in general too difficult, or is it too easy? In fact, I think the best definition of self-advocacy actually comes out of special education. Lauren Brinkerhoff, who was one of the developers of the IDEA legislation, said, and I'm going to read this because I think it's a lovely definition. Self-advocacy is the process of recognizing and then meeting the needs specific to your own learning ability without compromising the dignity of yourself or others. And I especially love that last phrase, without compromising the dignity of yourself or others, because in order to self-advocate, students must be in relationships with other people and respecting other people. And whether you're a student with a disability trying to have your needs met, or a student who is under-challenged in school, you need to work with the people around you to make changes.
Okay, thank you for that. That is a really clear definition that definitely applies to really all learners, whether they're identified with a special need or identified as gifted.
Oh, absolutely. Self-advocacy is such a valuable lifelong skill for everyone.
Right.
You know, for us in families and relationships, on the job. But that's why I'm focusing, of course, my background, the last 25 years of my professional career, I've been working with gifted students, and that's where my passion for this comes from. And I believe that in the educational system, where most kids are locked into what is available for them, it's critical for both struggling students and for advanced learners to figure out how to self-advocate, to work with the people around them.
Right. So I'm just going to take a moment to reintroduce you. You are listening to WGTD-HD-FM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of self-advocacy for gifted learners with author Deb Douglas is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So your system for preparing gifted learners to advocate for themselves includes four essential steps. I'm going to name them, and then we'll talk about each one separately.
Good.
So first one is understand their rights and responsibilities. Number two is develop their learner profiles. Number three is investigate available options and opportunities. And number four is connect with advocates. So let's talk about step one, understand their rights and responsibilities. Where do these rights and responsibilities come from?
Well, let me say, first of all, that I believe there are two major rights for the learners I'm trying to help. They have a right to understand what giftedness is and also what it isn't, and then how it relates to their unique selves. In the workshops that I do with students, and I've collected data from over 600 students now, one of the biggest concerns is that no one ever tells them what giftedness means. And so therefore, their misconception is that giftedness means you're in a program. And if you're not in a program, then you're not gifted. Unfortunately, a lot of our brightest students believe the same stereotypes that our society does, you know, as I mentioned before, that gifted students always do well, that they love school, that they do their homework, they get A's, they get into the best colleges and universities, And there are a whole lot of kids who are wonderfully successful at all of those things who may not be gifted. They are high achievers. They are hard workers. And their needs have been met through the K-12 educational system. So our kids need to have the right to know what giftedness is and that the myths around giftedness are not true. For instance, it's not true that all gifted kids will make it on their own. It's not true that only struggling students need help in what they're doing. It's not true that to ask for something different is elitist, because as we know from the federal definition, being defined as a gifted individual means you need something different. So I spend a lot of time in my workshops helping kids, first of all, understand that they have a right to understand themselves, and then they also have a right to an appropriately challenging education. And as I said, that right is laid out in the federal definition of giftedness and in state laws and in statutes, even if they're not enforced. And also I ask kids to look at their district mission statements, every one of which talks about what the district hopes to instill in all children or what they hope to provide for all children. And gifted kids need to understand that they are part of that all children who the district intends to serve, who we're looking out for.
Okay. So then step two is to develop their learner profiles. And I can't say that I've ever heard of this before. So what do you mean by that?
Well, if it's okay, I just want to go back for just a minute.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Responsibilities, too.
Oh, no, right.
Because it's very important that advanced learners understand that they have some responsibilities as well as the rights. It's not just privileges that they're looking for. They have a responsibility to take charge of their own education and not just sit back and assume that somebody else is going to do it for them. When I first started talking about this, one of the mothers of one of my students said, but why should my daughter have to advocate for herself? And as we just talked about, I said, because she can. She, with the right information and insights and strategies, she is capable of speaking up for herself. And what a wonderful skill to reinforce and to support and encourage. So all children have the responsibility to take charge of their own education. Some children are more ready to do it and have greater strength in doing that early on. But also our responsibility of all gifted students is to develop what I call the attributes of good character. They need to know that they need to work hard. Just because you're bright doesn't mean things should be easy. They need to complete assignments. You know, being bored with something is no excuse for not doing your homework or doing poor work. They need to learn to work well in a group like all students do. They need to learn to be attentive and organized. And actually, a lot of the gifted kids I know are not, well, I call them, they are independently organized. They have their own system of organization, but it doesn't mean that they're always the model student in the classroom.
Right.
So they need to work on those. So those are the rights and responsibilities that I think we need to help students understand and value. That's step one. Yep.
Okay. Sorry. Now we'll go to step two, develop their learner profiles. So tell us about that.
Well, I got this idea from the work of Dr. Karen Rogers, who wrote in the early 2000s, wrote a book called Reforming Gifted Education, Matching the Program to the Child. And if parents or teachers are really interested in diving into this idea of the learner profile, she has the whole book is a way to assess students' readiness for different options in education. But what she says and what I tell the students is we need to identify and reflect on five aspects of you as a learner. One is your intellectual ability. And so when I'm working with gifted kids, I try to help them understand not just what their IQ is, but what the specifics of their intellectual abilities are and areas that they can continue to grow in those. Because we all know that about growth mindset and that even gifted learners can develop the skills they already have. So intellectual ability is the first part of the learner profile. Then learning strengths, what areas are students specifically strong in? And the inverse, where do they have some weaknesses that they may need to work on? The third part is their interests. What are your family interests? What are your peer interests? What are your personal interests and passions? What things do you really care about? And then the question becomes, how can you incorporate that into your education, which will make it more motivating? The fourth thing is students should reflect on their learning preferences. And by that, I mean, how do they like to learn? How do they learn best? What kind of classroom activities are lead them to the greatest understandings? If they get to choose the way in which they show that they know, do they prefer standard tests or do they prefer presentations or essays, or how do they like to demonstrate that they've actually learned something? And then finally, the fifth part of their learner profile are their personal characteristics. And there are a few that are especially important for gifted kids to focus on. One is perfectionism. We know that not all gifted kids are perfectionists, and all perfectionists are gifted. But kids need to understand if perfectionism is leading them to do a great job, or is perfectionism actually maladaptive and keeping them from doing the things they need to do, keeping them, making them procrastinate, maybe that sort of thing. So understanding perfectionism, understanding introversion and extroversion and how that might affect them in not just in self-advocating, but in every day in the classroom. Some pretty good research has indicated that while the majority of the general public are extroverts and get their energies from interacting with other people, actually a majority of gifted kids are introverts and need that quiet time away from other people to recharge. They get their energy from within. And so for us as parents and educators to realize that, and for kids to realize that about themselves, helps them make some good choices.
Yeah, that I recognize a lot of those traits. So yeah, I can see where it would be important to actually have the student or the child or even the adult, I suppose, kind of think through all of those traits, and that would help them do the next step, which would be investigating available options and opportunities. So how do a gifted student or their parents go about this? Or do you really encourage it for the students to do it?
Well, I encourage it for students, but like in all learning processes, if they have supportive parents, family members, or other adults around them, all students can benefit from having that kind of help in exploring these. I believe in what Karen Rogers' book said, we need to match the programming to the child. And that's why, you know, one size fits all doesn't work with students in general, but it especially doesn't work in gifted education. And we tend to do that. Even if your district has a gifted program, it's like, well, this is the program you're in, and this is what you get in this program. And yet, as we've already talked about, gifted kids are as different from each other as they are from the general population. So one size doesn't fit all. In fact, it can be detrimental to all. So in order to match the program to the child, there are a few things that the child and the supportive adults around them need to remember. First of all, with the Wisconsin, whatever forces are at work in Wisconsin for gifted kids, you'll find on the DPI website. And that recommends three levels of services for gifted kids. And the first tier is in-class differentiation, things that the teacher can do within the classroom to meet the varied needs of all the students in the classroom. Now, differentiation in the classroom is a real skill that has to be learned, and teachers need to be given the time and the resources and the education to figure it out. But that is a wonderful place for, since most gifted kids are in the heterogeneous classroom, that's a wonderful place for that first tier of programming to happen. But then depending upon the student's individual needs, they may need some supplemental options. They may need maybe a subject acceleration or a compacting of a particular unit that they've already mastered so that they can be doing some more challenging work, or they may be, need to go faster or deeper in a subject. And there's also a third tier, and that's generally where a gifted student would have a differentiated educational plan, similar to an IEP, that would lay out an individually designed intervention or interventions for that student. And so if the student begins to recognize where they fall in this whole broad field of gifted education, and which subjects and at what unit, at what time, with what teacher, then they and the people around them can help determine what level or what tier of assistance they need at that time. I think also we need to look at, find out from our school if there's a district plan for gifted education that includes options. And I admit to when I was a district coordinator, kind of running a stealth program, as many districts do, in that we don't want to cause too much disruption, and we don't want students or parents asking for things that are not appropriate for their students. We don't want anyone to feel left out. We are afraid that if we talk about our plan, someone will think it's elitist, and so we don't often broadcast. The options that are available in our district. And I believe we need to do that. And if your district isn't telling you about their plan, you need to ask them if they have a plan. By law, they have to have a plan. Like I said, it's not very well supervised and no one's holding them accountable for that, but it should be there. We need to figure out what's already available in school, and then don't stop there, to figure out what could be created, what options could be available. We need to help kids look at the secondary, the middle school, and the high school course catalogs to find out what might be ahead for them. And if it's an area where they have extreme abilities, maybe how can we accelerate them into some of those areas sooner, and maybe have them be in elementary school and middle school at the same time, or middle school and high school, going between the two. So those are some possibilities. We also need to look at what's available in the community. And today, what's available online? What are the extraordinary programs that really will challenge kids at the correct pace and depth that we can find?
Okay. And then step four is connect with advocates. So who are these advocates?
Well, of course, they're anyone who can provide information for the kids and help them open doors, who can support them. So parents and teachers are the first advocates. If your school has a gifted coordinator or advanced learner coordinator or student achievement coordinator, whatever we call it, they also are great advocates. I found the school counselors can be wonderful advocates too. Unfortunately, they are normally responsible for hundreds of students within their school or their district. And most of them tell me that they only have interactions with gifted kids when there's a problem. But if we help our gifted kids in helping them to self-advocate, often we need the work of a school counselor to help arrange whatever options the students are looking for. And administrators, too, they need to be advocates. In fact, in my book, I lay out how every single player in the school district, including parents and students, can reinforce and encourage students to self-advocate. You know, there's also regional groups. And kids, I think our gifted kids need to know that if they're struggling from lack of challenge or have some specific needs because of their giftedness, that they're not alone out there, that they are part of this huge world of gifted individuals who need help and assistance. And so knowing that, for instance, there are CESA groups and regional support groups for them, that there is the Wisconsin Association for Talented and Gifted, whose sole purpose is to advocate for kids' challenges. The National Association for Gifted Kids. And like you mentioned, there are international groups and groups on other continents that struggle with the same concerns we do here in the United States.
Right.
And I want to mention three resources in particular. The Davidson Institute out of Reno, Nevada, has an online school for gifted kids. They have a brick and mortar school for gifted kids. They have Davidson Scholars, who are given resources to do extraordinary research. Check out the Davidson Institute. Also, check out the Jack Kent Cook Foundation. You may have heard that advertised on public radio. It's another foundation that is designed to help disadvantaged gifted kids. And also the Institute for Educational Advancement, the IEA, again, has a tremendous amount of resources, thanks to a wonderful sponsor, to help kids, gifted kids, get the situations that they need in which they'll have appropriate educations. And for anyone who just wants to know more about this topic, there is a website called Hoagies, Hoagies, started and run by a gifted woman, a mother of gifted children, and it is a compendium of everything gifted, all the articles, all the research, all the user-friendly sites that will help anyone understand more about the needs of gifted kids.
Okay. So I know there's one other organization near us. And in fact, I don't know if they still do this, but a while ago, so the first time students take standardized tests in second or third grade, they're identified if they're a high scorer, and the families get a letter that gives them the option of opting into an elementary gifted program. But they're also referred to the Center for Talent Development at Northwestern University. Are you aware of that organization?
Oh, I am. Yes, hon. I've worked with them, and I've done some of their award ceremonies right here in Madison. Northwestern University's program, it's called NUMATS, mm-hmm. and it's the Midwest Academic Talent Search. And as part of that talent search, students who are high achieving on standardized tests are offered the opportunity to take out-of-level tests. And they're great because they take the ceiling off of the test. A student who's always scoring in the 99th percentile of standardized tests doesn't know how far they could go. So that means that in upper elementary kids will be taking, it used to be the Explorer test. I'm not sure what the name of it is right now. And middle school kids would be taking the ACT and the SAT, you know, the college bound students test, but they take it much earlier. And that allows, as I say, the ceiling to be removed and for us to find out in the areas that are tested, where can students really go above and beyond? And students who score well on those exams are invited to be part of the Center for Talent Development. In Wisconsin, they're invited to be part of the programming for the Wisconsin Center for Academically Talented Youth, a similar program on a smaller scale. And actually, if they are part of the talent search, they will get invitations to participate in programming, both weekend and summer programming at major universities across the country. Unfortunately, many of those are extraordinarily expensive, and even though scholarships are available, it means that students need to be ready to leave home for a week or more and live on a campus and be involved in the programming there. It's excellent programming.
Mm-hmm. But I think you're right that not every child, when they're identified, is ready to do that even in sixth or seventh grade. Some of them would be, but a lot of them are not, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and not every district is even aware of that or even allows kids to be part of that or notifies parents. It's if your district did or if districts around the states are, I think parents need to recognize that their district is doing their best to offer whatever kind of opportunities are out there for kids and just be grateful that they are doing that part of it.
Yeah, and I would just note for any parents who are listening, there's going to be a post on our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page about this. So if you have worked, have had your child or you yourself have attended any of these programs and you want to share with other families, that might be a good place to sort of start a community discussion. So we encourage you to do that. I'm also going to try to put all these organizations that you just named in the comments on our post so that people can access them.
Oh, great.
So I appreciate that. Once again, this is WGTD HDFM Education Matters, and we're talking with Deb Douglas about her book, Self-Advocacy for Gifted Learners. You can listen to the whole program in case you happen to want to hear it again or you're tuning in midway through at WGTD.org. Look for the Education Matters page within our website, and it'll be archived there, and you can listen again. So here's a couple of questions for people who maybe are not involved with deeply with gifted education. So what is your stance on gifted learners skipping grades?
I think I know that there's a great deal of excellent research, especially out of the Bell and Blank Center, Gifted Research Center at the University of Iowa, that has found that grade acceleration, skipping grades, is one of the easiest and most effective ways of giving a gifted student the appropriate challenge and pace that they need. However, and here's my caveat, it's not right for every student. The Bell and Blank Center has developed the Iowa Acceleration Scale, frequently called the IAS, that is a wonderful assessment of an individual child readiness or fit with accelerate a grade acceleration, and it brings together all the adults, the specialists, the parents, everyone in the child's life and the child to assess all aspects of that child and to give a recommendation on whether or not acceleration would be a good idea. I have seen examples of perfect acceleration, and I've seen examples of students who were misaccelerated and fell back in many reasons, in many ways, because we had not used the acceleration scale. Mm-hmm. So yes, it's absolutely fantastic, but don't do it helter skelter.
Right.
Right.
So a school counselor would be someone who would be able to administer that scale?
Well, yes.
Or a school psychologist?
It could be a psychologist, but it's not just a test. The mm-hmm. Iowa Acceleration Scale brings together the current year's teacher, the teacher frequently from the year before, depending upon where in the school year it might be worked on, the teacher in the next year. It brings together the school counselor, a school psychologist, the parent, the student, the gifted coordinator. Hopefully there is one in their district. And each of them has a section of the scale to fill out and to interview the child about and to bring all the data back together and to determine if indeed this is a good strategy for this child. It asks such simple things as, is there another child in the family who will be in the same grade? And how does that affect this acceleration?
Right.
So it's looking at a ton of things, not just test scores. And that's why it is so valid and so helpful.
Hmm. Yes, that does sound helpful. So as predicted, we're way over, you know, we have many more questions than we have time to answer. But I do think this is how I tend to end all interviews. Our listeners really appreciate stories about real successes. Could you describe for us a student, and then if there's time, a teacher and maybe a school that was changed for the better by the application of the ideas that you advocate in your book?
Oh, I am filled to the brim with stories about successful student self-advocacy, so you're going to have to shut me off. But let me give you just a couple examples of student self-advocacy that changed not only their immediate educational path, but also wound up changing a lot in the district as well. Ben was a student who was in seventh grade, looked ahead to eighth grade, and realized that because of his passion for science and his own research and investigations into science matters, eighth grade science was really not going to be challenging for him. And he asked me if he could skip. So I went to the eighth grade science teachers who said, no, there's a lot of curriculum he hasn't studied and that's important and eighth grade science is important. No, he can't skip it. So I went back to Ben and we regrouped and he came back with a plan of how about if I take home the eighth grade science textbook over the summer, I read every chapter, I do every question, end of chapter question, I come back and I take whatever exams they want to give me, and if I pass it, can I then skip eighth grade science? And I went back to the teachers who said, and the science department head who said, well, sure. Of course, they didn't think any child would do that. But of course, Ben did.
Yeah.
He wanted to do it. And he came back at the end of the summer, took the exams, and they placed him in ninth grade physical science. Ninth grade physical science teacher was a little leery of having a young kid in there, but he took them. And of course, by the end of the year, he was the teacher's, I won't say favorite student, but most successful student in that class because of his passion and motivation for science. Mm-hmm. So the science teachers got together and they said, there may be other students like Ben if he's willing to do this. How can we move them ahead faster? Because what Ben really wanted to do was find time in his high school schedule to take as many science classes as he could. Uh-huh. And so for a while, they had a compacted seventh and eighth grade science class that lasted 1 year, but included all the curriculum kids needed to do. But because the kids were motivated and capable, they moved more quickly through it. They also decided that in ninth grade, they'd open up either biology or physical science for kids so that kids could flip those around depending upon where their passion was in the physical sciences or in the life sciences. So because Ben knew he had something that he really wanted, and because we worked successfully through many bumps in the road to make it happen, he actually changed the whole system.
That's a great story, and we are actually out of time now, but I think it illustrated exactly what we're looking at because it was teachers, district, and student working together. So thank you so much, Deb, for talking with us. You've given us a lot to think about, and hopefully we'll have a little discussion on our Facebook page. You've been listening to WGTD HDFM. This is Education Matters. This discussion of self-advocacy for gifted learners with author Deb Douglas is archived at WGTD.org. On the Education Matters page. Thank you so much for listening.